The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Asthma is presented by Dr. Timothy Craig.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm at a little disadvantage. I can't see over the podium at my slides, so hopefully this will project. Is this okay if I stand here? I'm actually not a podium person. I'd rather walk around, but in any case, here we are. So I wanted to walk through what I think are pertinent questions and based on the asthma guidelines, and then I'll deviate a little on that. But I think if you know the guidelines, you can actually answer most questions about asthma nowadays. So this is what my objectives are. Talk about the guidelines. Talk about how you determine when you first see a patient asthma severity, because that's what you do. Then you treat them according to that. Then you have them back and determine their asthma control. Based on that, you readjust their medications and hoping that this will improve patient outcome. Now, one of the disadvantages I have is that we haven't really done new asthma guidelines in the United States since 2007. And there's been a few drugs that have been added to the marketplace that I think you need to know about. And I've added them in too towards the end, and we'll chat about them a little bit. I also try to make it a kind of more case-based, question-based, and I hope that's acceptable to most of you. So we'll start off. This is a 19-year-old male with asthma since age 5. He presents with EIB, or exercise-induced bronchospasm, and year-round nasal congestion. He denies daytime symptoms. Nighttime symptoms he has 2 times per month. He uses short-acting beta agonists just pre-exercise, no other times. He never has used any other type of inhaler, and he has moderate limitation in his ability to exercise because of his asthma. He's had no ER visits or hospitalization. So if you were to see this guy in clinic, you would be saying, so in your own mind, what is his asthma severity, and what do you do now? So let's look at that. So what is his asthma severity? Is he mild intermittent? Is he mild persistent? Is he moderate persistent? Or is he a severe persistent asthmatic? So let's kind of look at the answer here. So I think he's a moderate persistent asthmatic, and I'll tell you why. So this is the guidelines. So you can see a couple of things on the guidelines. Who wants me to point to the right, and who wants me to point to the left? Anybody want me to point to the left? Raise your hands. Anybody wants to point to the right, raise your, oh, it's a tie, how about that? So, here are the questions you need to ask every asthmatic, right there. So you need to know how many symptoms they've had a week. You need to know how many albuterol inhales they had over a week, or uses of albuterol, I'm sorry. How many nighttime symptoms they had in the last month, how many exacerbations they had in the last year, and then any limitation of their exercise. Now you can determine asthma severity without a pulmonary function test, and so we won't talk about that. So if I was to look at his asthma severity here, I said that he's not using albuterol except for pre-exercise, right? So if you look at the use of albuterol, he would be intermittent asthmatic here. If I talked about his daytime symptoms, he would still be intermittent asthma. If I talked about his nighttime symptoms, he would still range in that area. And if I talked about his exacerbations, he would still be in that area. But if you look at interference with normal activity and you go across, he has some limitation in his activities, and so I would say he's moderate persistent based on that. And you always determine their severity based on their worst characteristic. So I'm very firm on being able to do that in my own mind. And from this, I'll be able to determine therapy. Now, the one thing, the key to this is this right here, this break point right here, break point right there. So it's called the rule of twos, right? So you know if you see a patient in your clinic, if they have daytime symptoms more than twice a week, albuterol use more than twice a week, if they have any limitation in their exercise, if they have more than 2 nocturnal awakenings in a month, or 2 or more exacerbations in the last year, you know that that person has to start on some kind of anti-inflammatory therapy or maintenance therapy. So that is the most important part of the whole table here, is to know that break point. So let's see. So how would you treat that guy if I said he had moderate persistent asthma? Would you start him on a long-acting beta agonist? Would you say he should start on a medium-dose inhaled steroid? Should it be on a high-dose inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist, or should it be on a low dose of inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist? So let's look at the answer. So I think, you see, I changed it without changing the stem. If I was to do that, I would have him on a medium base of inhaled steroid with a long-acting beta agonist. So let's go through the choices here. Should he be on a long-acting beta agonist by itself? No way, right? Because at least in asthma, that's negligence, not in COPD. Should he be on a high dose of inhaled steroid? Well, you know, you could have said that prior because of the FDA letter that came out many years ago, but the studies have been done showing that long-acting beta agonists actually decrease exacerbations and don't increase the risk for sudden deaths. So I'd probably say, nah, you probably don't want to go to a high dose inhaled steroid. Probably want to add a long-acting beta agonist to decrease the dose of inhaled steroid. Would you want a low dose? Probably not. So I think the best dose here would be a medium dose of inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist. So let's look. So this is the treatment table. So you could see a couple things. Step one, that's for mild intermittent asthma, it's just albuterol as necessary. Step two is for those people who have mild asthma. Low dose inhaled steroids, fine with them. Some people may be able to be managed with a montelukast and similar drugs. Step three and four are for moderate asthma. From low dose to a high dose inhaled steroid combined with a long-acting beta agonist, you have other options, but for a test, I don't think they'll ever ask you that. And then step five and six, for severe asthma, all these people should be on a high-dose inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist, and in most cases should be on something else if they're not controlled. So for our guy, I think our therapy of a medium dose of inhaled steroid with a long-acting beta agonist is very appropriate for his by his asthma severity. So here's his pulmonary function test. FVC is 90%, FEV1 is 80. Ratio is 85%, so he's totally normal by pulmonary function test. Chest x-ray was normal. I would only get that the first time I see him unless he had some change in his symptoms. Skin tests were positive to house dust mites. He was prescribed a medium dose of inhaled steroid and long-acting beta agonist, as we talked about. Started on nasal steroids because his main symptom was congestion. He was given albuterol as necessary, prednisone for severe asthma if he needed it. Talked about education, compliance, or adherence, and an acute asthma action plan. And by his skin test, he was also educated about mite avoidance. So pretty comprehensive care, I think. So he returns in 3 months. He's been using his inhaled steroid and his long-acting beta agonist regularly. Denies any nighttime symptoms, daytime symptoms, or exercise-related symptoms. So those are three questions right there that you would need to ask, right? His quality of life, he says, is good. Albuterol in the last week has, again, only been pre-exercise, but he's used prednisone 3 times in the last couple months here because of asthma attacks. Again, his breathing test was normal. So what is his asthma control, and what would you do now? It didn't progress. There it is. What is his asthma control? So, is he mild persistent? Well, you know that's not the answer, right? Because we're talking about control. Is he well controlled? Is he not well controlled? Or is he very poorly controlled? So let's look at the answer on this. So I would say he's very poorly controlled. He's had enough exacerbations in 12 weeks to last him a full year. So I would treat him as such. And we have him on a medium dose inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist. So you know what my next question is going to be to you is what would you do with his therapy? So let's look first about control. So thankfully so, when they made this template, they had the same questions as for asthma severity. That is daytime symptoms, nighttime symptoms, albuterol use, exacerbations, and exercise, quality of life functioning question. And you know, they still included a the rule of twos, which is kind of nice. Break point right here, break point right there. So if he had less than two symptoms a week, or two or less symptoms a week, two or less albuterol uses a week, if he had less two or less nocturnal awakenings per month, if he had less than two exacerbations in a year, and he had a total normal exercise tolerance and functionality, you would obviously say he was well controlled and you would decrease his therapy. But that's not the case with our guy, right? So he falls into this exacerbation, even though all his other questions show that he's well controlled. The exacerbations is the one part that differs, and so you would have to intensify his therapy based on his control, and that would be my next question, right? So what would you do now? Would you increase to high dose inhaled steroid? Increases in here, oh, geez, I made a mistake there, so A and B. Start a short-acting anticholinergic, add xylutant, add omalizumab. So what would the answer be? So I think the answer would be B, but actually he's already on a long-acting beta agonist and inhaled steroid, so increasing his inhaled steroid to a higher dose wouldn't be inappropriate, keeping the long-acting beta agonist. So there's actually two answers for this one. But again, the correct answer, the best answer, would be increases inhaled steroid to high dose, continuing his long-acting beta agonist. So let's see if we're correct. Well, we said he was sitting right here in step four, right? Before, for moderate asthma. Now we're saying he's poorly controlled, so we'd step up care, and that would bring us right here, high-dose inhaled steroid and long-acting beta agonist. We may want to stop prednisone. I probably would not on this guy, so we're right there. And we might want to consider omalizumab, but I'd probably first have him on this therapy before moving him to a monoclonal. So I think according to the guidelines, we have him sitting exactly where he should be. And then when we see him next, then we're going to have to again reassess his asthma control. He'll always maintain himself at a moderate severity in asthma. And based on his control, again, we'll go up or down in his medications. So this visit, we prescribed him a peak flow meter. He was on a high-dose inhaled steroid plus the long-acting beta agonist. We considered omalizumab, mepolizumab as an alternative, which is not on the guidelines, but we'll talk about that in a second. He is on a short-acting beta agonist as necessary and pre-exercise. He'll increase his albuterol for yellow zone, prednisone for red zone, and we plan to see him back in a month. So, let's kind of look at the guidelines again. So remember, first time you see a person, you set their asthma severity, and the rule of twos prevails on this, so you know anybody greater than two in any of those questions really has to be on some kind of maintenance medication. If they're less than two, albuterol as necessary is all that's you can prescribe, all you need to prescribe. Then, based on that asthma severity, you're going to treat them appropriately so. Again, step one being for just mild intermittent asthma, step two for mild asthma, step three and four for moderate asthma, step five and six for severe asthma. And then you're going to send them away and then determine their asthma control. And their asthma control is this. Again, rule of twos, same questions. Again, if they have any of those questions more than twice a week, you need to intensify their therapy. If not, then you may want to downgrade their therapy. And you would base your change in therapy on this template. Now, please note a few things, very important. Is here, it says, before you change medications, check technique and check adherence, because the most common reason people fail to use, the most common reason people fail to respond to your therapy is because they're either not using the medication or because they're using it incorrectly. In the United States, I always thought about non-adherence, but if you look at the world guidelines, which includes Western Europe, it's more poor technique. So that's what they say. Maybe they're more adherent in Europe than here, but one of those two would be the proper answer if people aren't responding initially to therapy to do. It also says that if you have people using albuterol, more than a couple times a week, you need to increase their therapy. It also says on here that You wait 3 months before stopping therapy, and I think that's very important because of the inflammation. So again, you don't see a person back in 2 weeks, determine their control, and decrease their therapy. You want to wait a good portion of time, about 3 months. Then you determine at that point of time whether or not to decrease their therapy if they're still controlled. So there's some new changes in therapy since the guidelines. Tiotropium is an important agent and can be added to either inhaled steroids or long-acting beta agonists or just to an inhaled steroid itself. So, and there's good data to support that, even though it's not in the guidelines, but it will be in the next set. Also, ipratropium bromide, really now that we have long-acting anticholinergics, probably little need to use Atrovent or ipratropium bromide, except for an emergency situation such as an ER. And then we know that it decreases the risk for hospitalization by using it in a person who's already maxed out on beta agonists. Mepolizumab does work for people. Its indications really are based on eosinophil counts and not on IgE, as is omalizumab. And it can be a viable therapy for those people who are in step 5 and 6 care and are not responding. Please remember both with mepolizumab and omalizumab, both of them are mainly used to decrease exacerbations. They really don't change FEV1 much. So a couple other things have changed. So there was a couple good articles coming out, or came out, in the New England Journal of Medicine, and anything that's in that journal is very suitable to test on a question. And it was looking at montelukast. Now, no way montelukast is as good as an inhaled steroid. In fact, only about 65% of people respond to montelukast. But over years, because of non-compliance to inhalers, actually montelukast looked just as good as an inhaled steroid over time, and that's important to remember. Also, the combination of long-acting beta agonists with inhaled steroid are far better than an inhaled steroid with montelukast, but again, because of compliance to inhalers, the combination of montelukast with an inhaled steroid looked just as good over time. Not that it is as good. And again, the response rates are about 65%. We also know aerobic exercise downregulates the cytokines important for T helper 2 cells, and so actually are a therapeutic intervention for asthma. And we know that vitamin D chronically is low in a lot of asthmatics and may, depending on the study you believe, may have some benefit at steroid sparing. Now, there's actually conflicting research out there. I'm not sure really where you would go, but if you had a question, I would probably go that vitamin D is low in asthmatics and that if you replace vitamin D, you can increase steroid or decrease steroid resistance. And then macrolides have been looked at in asthma. At first, it was thought that people should try it on most asthmatics who are poor responders to inhaled steroids. I think probably that's not worth it. There's only a small subgroup of people who actually respond to macrolides. But if you have neutrophils in the airway instead of eosinophils, that might be one group. If you have people maximized on other therapies and they're still not getting better, a trial of macrolides may be an advantage for your patient. So what's important about the guidelines? I guess I already kind of said that. Severity, right? Therapy. Then you're going to determine control. And then you're going to readjust your therapy based on that. Again, as I mentioned, the rule of twos are very important. And also, the inhaled steroids are stressed in all aspects except for that mild intermittent asthmatic. And I already talked about the rule of twos. Again, easy question to remember. And those 5 questions really should be given to you on any board test. So let's look at another case since we have about 10 minutes left. So this is a 35-year-old banker. He's frustrated with the care. He says doctors just don't listen to him. He's had asthma since age 3, always stable, but now at 35, he's pretty miserable. He no longer can run, and he's had about 3 attacks in the last year requiring prednisone. So what are some of the possibilities that may result in an asthma attack in this individual? Is it staph lung infections? Is it warm, humid air? Is it reflux? Is it pneumococcal infections or is it a rhinovirus? So the answer would be E. So if we walk through that, typical bacteria, right, don't exacerbate asthma. That includes pneumococcal and staph, so we can eliminate them. We know that with COPD on inhaled steroids, there's an increased risk of pneumonia, right, and you want to vaccinate them. In asthma, that's more questionable. But pneumococcal usually does not cause a flare of asthma. Reflux, there were some data, but the most recent data suggests that reflux doesn't trigger asthma. It may coincide with asthma and should be treated appropriately so, but probably doesn't make asthma worse. But rhinoviruses are one of the most common reasons people have exacerbations, also one of the most common reasons people end up in the emergency room. So what is the most common cause for poor asthma control? Oh, I already gave this answer away. Hopefully you don't get this right. Is it poor technique, poor compliance, undertreatment, or failure to recognize asthma severity by the doctor? So let's look at that. Well, I think it's poor technique, and that's hard to answer the question because the most recent guidelines suggest that. Prior to that, it was poor compliance. Undertreatment is a problem, probably not the most common, and also failure for doctors to recognize asthma severity is a problem. That's why you have to ask those five questions to determine asthma control and asthma severity. So that doesn't happen. Remember that a person, when you ask them about their asthma severity, they'll say they're well controlled unless they've gone to the emergency room twice during a year's period of time. So again, that's why you have to ask all those questions, not just how do you think your asthma is. So some of the other reasons that you may have uncontrolled asthma, as I mentioned, poor adherence and poor technique are a problem, undertreatment by doctors, and underappreciation by patients of their asthma severity, tobacco abuse, right? If tobacco prevents the inhaled steroids from having efficacy, at least in FEV1. So if you smoke, even with a high dose inhaled steroid, you're unlikely to have a significant change in FEV1. Allergen exposure is very important. Occupational exposure is very important. And 15% of asthmatics out there are actually probably have most of their symptoms related to their occupation. Medications can also exacerbate asthma, including ACE inhibitors, which increase hyperreactivity of the airway, but also induce cough in 20%, which can make you feel that the asthma is poorly controlled when it may not be. Aspirin in about 15% of asthmatics may be an underlying cause for exacerbations. And then non-selective beta blockers. Selective beta blockers are less of a problem, as you all know. Infections. We talked about viruses being number one, but also atypical bacteria. And then upper airway inflammation, sinusitis, rhinitis, also is correlated with poor asthma control. And then most importantly, depression and poor social systems, only because non-adherence is so high in this population. So let's go back to our case. So again, 35-year-old, frustrated with his care, his asthma in the past. Now he's needed some more prednisone. He's unable to exercise. He otherwise denies any allergies. Family history is positive for asthma. He's a non-smoker. He does have a cat, but he got rid of it, traded it for a goldfish. He tolerates aspirin and non-steroidals with no problem. And his review of systems is remarkable for anxiety, but mainly associated with his asthma as of lately. His exam, really unremarkable, except for what you would expect. He has some nasal congestion, some boggy mucosa. He has some pharyngeal erythema and cobblestone, and he has some scattered wheeze on his lung exam. So what test would you order at this time? A sinus CT scan, a pH probe, a DLCO, spirometry, or skin testing? So hopefully this would be a pretty easy one, right? Would be spirometry. CT scan, you could almost guarantee in a severe person that their sinuses will be involved, not 100%, but it's pretty sensitive. pH probe, well, probably not. You would treat his reflux and maybe if it's refractory, then worry about it. A DLCO, well, if you're worried about defining COPD or separating COPD from asthma, that might help you a little bit, or if he had restrictive lung disease. Pulmonary function testing may go that way, but probably too early to do that at this time. Skin testing, definitely not, because that would be contraindicated in a person who has unstable asthma. So the reason, the obvious statement here would be spirometry. So spirometry was done. His FVC was 92%, FEV1 was 68, his ratio was 70. He reversed 16% with 4 puffs of albuterol. His chest x-ray showed some hyperinflation. And he was initiated, treatment was initiated, and he had a return visit where he was skin tested. So based on this, you look at those numbers, he does have obstructive lung disease. He does reverse enough, so 12%, right? 200 cc's in an adult is where you want to be to demonstrate reversibility. So he does look like an asthmatic. He does probably, I don't have that number, but reverse greater than a ratio of 70%. So by definition, he doesn't have COPD. So going back to him, he hasn't changed his history. It's still the same. So what is his asthma severity? Is he mild, intermittent, mild, persistent, moderate, persistent, or severe, persistent? So by me, I think he's severe persistent, right? He's unable to exercise. That puts him in the category going across with interference of light on life is extremely limited. Go across here, right? Extremely limited. So I would say he is, based on that alone, no other feature, he has very poor asthma or very severe asthma. So recommendations. So I think there's a variety of recommendations. I think you would treat his asthma aggressively with a high-dose inhaled steroid and a long-acting beta agonist. Probably nasal steroids because his main symptom is congestion. Reassurance. He would be a perfect person to educate on an action plan because of his anxiety and need for control. Review his asthma medications. Educate him on technique. And also, I think determining his hypersensitivities would be important. So again, based on how you gave him, the asthma severity you gave him, puts him into step 5 or 6 for therapy, which is the high dose inhaled steroid and the long-acting beta agonist. So 2 weeks later, you saw him, still on the medication. He's been very compliant. His exercise has improved. He's now sleeping through the night, or he continues to sleep through the night, not have any daytime symptoms. He's not using albuterol. Quality of life is great. He's not needed any urgent care, and his spirometry was normal. Skin tests were positive to cats and dust mites. So what would his asthma control be? So I think he's well controlled, and again, if you look at that template, he definitely is underneath that rule of 2s for all symptoms, right? And he's exercising regularly, so he's right in this area, right? So well controlled, no doubt. So the question would be, what would you do now? Would you drop off his long-acting beta agonist? Would you start omalizumab? Would you review his asthma action plan? Or would you decrease him to a low-dose inhaled steroid? Let's look at the answer. Well, I think C would be the answer. So remember, let me go back there, if I can, yeah. So it's only been a couple weeks, right? And remember, you should maintain therapy for about 3 months before downgrading therapy. So obviously, A would not be appropriate. Either would D. I'm sorry, here I am pointing at that. A and D are not appropriate. You wouldn't want to start omalizumab because now he's well controlled, right? So I think the best thing would be watching his technique and reviewing his asthma action plan with him, and that's all you would need to do. Probably have him back in 3 months, and at that time, decide if you're going to decrease therapy further. So your patient has severe persistent asthma that's well controlled. Follow up at 3 months, you consider decreasing the dose of inhaled steroid on his next visit. And if he's worse, then you would consider omalizumab and tiotropium or mepolizumab to his regimen. So let me summarize where we are. So again, asthma severity, first visit, asthma controlled subsequent visits. Always remember to ask about his function, exercise and so on, and also his exacerbations. Inhaled steroids, by far the drug of choice. The addition of omalizumab further decreases exacerbations, and that's why it's added to maximum therapy. But remember, it is costly, about $30,000. As compared to HAE drugs, that's cheap, but still it has some price associated, and that's why you would use it only at people who fail maximum therapy. The same with mepolizumab, which is about the same price. Xylutin can be added for moderate severe asthma, but probably not in the case of this patient. He's already past that stage. And prednisone, definitely important for severe persistent asthma. And they might actually, probably the dose nowadays is 40 milligrams at 5 days is what most people are using.